itself. The theory's past of the counterfactual theory is obviously taken from Hume's Other Words. So you get in the Other Words where if the first object had not been, the second object had never existed. And modern-day Humeans have obviously put forward the counterfactual theory. So modern-day Humeans hold something like Humean supervenience. Any world which is a minimal duplicate in terms of the qualities instantiated and their spatial-temporal arrangement of our world is a duplicate simpliciter of our world. And they think that one way in which Humean supervenience could fail is if there are necessary connections between distinct existences. So part of their support for Humean supervenience is the denial of a distinct existences principle. But it's also true, even for those modern Humeans, that they distinguish between their commitment to Humean supervenience and the distinct existences principle and the counterfactual theory of causation. They take the Humean supervenience principle, this is obviously Lewis I'm referring to, I should have said that, they take the Humean supervenience and the distinct existence principle as a contingent truth. On the other hand, they take the counterfactual theory of causation as a necessary truth. And here's a little passage from Lewis in his concessive mode. So he's saying about oomph, or biff, it might be a Humean supervenient relation, or it might be a relation posited by some anti-Humean metaphysic of nomological necessity. Myself, I'd like to think that the actual occupant of the biff role is Humean supervenient, physical, and at least fairly natural. So he actually then separates two distinct explanatory tasks, and this is another lengthy quote from Lewis. What is causation? As a matter of analytic necessity across all possible worlds, what is the unified, necessary, and sufficient condition for causation? It is somehow a matter of counterfactual dependence of events or absences on other events or absences. What is causation? As a matter of contingent fact, what is the feature of this world and of other possible worlds sufficiently like it on which the truth values of causal ascription supervene? It is biff, the pattern of relatedness of events to one another by the relation that is the actual occupant of the biff role. Biff is literally the basic kind of causation in this world anyway, the basis on which other varieties of causation supervene. So now, when people go and talk about their opposition to certain kinds of counterfactual theory, you might say, are they just debating about what is the actual occupant of the biff role, or are they putting forward a necessary condition on what causation is in general? And very often, process theorists and others say, well, we're just talking about causation as we find it in this world. They are then not in competition. We just have a debate about whether the counterfactual theory, or the counterfactuals that are true in this world, in some way depend upon what they've identified as the occupant of the biff role. The main opponents of the counterfactual theory of causation are the non-reductivists or the primitivists, those who say you can't go and analyze causation in terms of counterfactuals, and sometimes these opponents have a biff commitment. So they say that there's natural necessity, or that there are powers, or there are persisting tropes, or something like that. And I presume that these folk are thinking that that's what causation is like in all possible worlds. So in which case, that is the way in which they would depart from the counterfactualist. You could have no commitment to biff component, and various kinds of causally modeling approaches often have that character. So what happens if these folk go and seek to oppose the counterfactual theory of causation is they want to show that their biff commitment provides answers to problems that the counterfactualist faces. And this is part of the tease of my approach. What I'm going to do in at least two aspects is I'm going to say that the counterfactualist, shorn of the human commitments, because after all, they're not limited to human materials when the counterexamples come in, they can appeal to other things. they can draw upon the materials these other folk appeal to and say, thank you very much, you provided the additional stuff I needed, I don't now no longer have a problem. So here's a little illustration of the thank you very much strategy. The counterexample is due to Douglas Ehring. So here we have, there are two qualitatively indistinguishable particles, right? So obviously qualitatively indistinguishable but distinct particles is trying to suggest a bit of denial of human supervenience. There are two qualitatively indistinguishable particles with equal quantities of energy moving on collision course. The laws mandate that if these two particles collide, one and only one particle will transfer its energy non-continuously across a spatial gap to a third particle some distance away, and that the energy of the other particle will simply be annihilated. However, each particle has some probability less than one of transferring its energy or having its energy annihilated. Given the laws, whichever particle does the transferring, it is true that had that particle not transferred its energy to the third particle, the other would have. So this is, here's special thanks to Emma Sullivan Bissett, who actually taught me motion paths. This is the most sophisticated PowerPoint presentation I've ever managed to do. Right? So here's the case, presumably Ehring's case. And they look at that. Yeah, that's just so nice. So that's the thing he's envisaging. And the sort of point that he's trying to make is that this presents a problem for the counterfactualist. The top's particle possession of a quantity of energy caused the lone particle's possession of the quantity of energy. Because the top particle transferred its energy, the bottom particle's possession of quantity of energy, E, did not. Now we look at the counterfactuals. If the top particle hadn't possessed the quantity of energy E, then the lone particle wouldn't have possessed the quantity of energy E. Well, that's false, because the bottom particle would have caused the lone particle to possess the quantity of energy E according to the laws. But if you then try to go and delete both, if neither particle possessed the quantity of energy E, then the lone particle wouldn't have possessed the quantity of energy E. This would be true for both. So how do you distinguish between making the top particle the cause of the energy transfer and not the bottom? So what the Humean does is something like this. Now, note, the purple and the red here is not trying to indicate different qualities, but different token energies of precisely the same level. Okay, I can't actually represent tokens effectively as yet on PowerPoint. So here we go. Alan says, well, look, lo and behold, you see it's the red token which does it. So now you look at the counterfactual and say, well, these two things are the token quantities of energy of E of the same size. The lone particle's possession of one rather than another is a non-human supervenient difference of identity by Ehring's hypothesis. If that's true, the following is true. If the top particle hadn't possessed red fill, then the lone particle wouldn't have possessed red fill. This would be only true for the top, because in the case of the bottom, being purple. So what the Humean effectively has done there is just said, all right, if you deny humanism about identity, then I can appeal to that to go and explain how the counterfactual dependence holds. Now, that's the general structure of the point. As you observe, that's just one. You might disagree with that, but of course there are going to be a whole host of cases, and maybe some of them don't have that kind of easy resolution, even if you accept that one. So it is kind of just a structural point I'm making. Once you shear off various commitments of human supervenience, there will be materials the counterfactualists can appeal to. So now I'm imagining my opponents are going to go and say something of the following line. They're going to say, yeah, but you're far too over-liberal. You're going to allow for causation in places where you just shouldn't allow for causation. And two particular areas of this will be human supervenient worlds. These are causation-free worlds. It's not the case that there's causation there. There's just the effects jangling about, doing not very much at all, but just getting themselves in various kinds of patterns. And then they were going to say stuff about double prevention cases and others. I'm just focusing upon them. And say that these are not really causation, because they don't involve their preferred feature. So now there's some folk who've had the misfortune of hearing me on various aspects of this. So the first one, the human supervenient worlds, I'm going to give a general sketch, but I'm going to go and be quite quick about that. So it's just going to suggest a line of approach, but it's not going to satisfy people who want detailed textual argumentation. But, you know, that would be utterly unreasonable to expect in a situation like this anyway. So, let's characterize what the folk who are anti the human worlds counting as causal worlds, they in a way are putting something like the following modal argument. They're saying, look, it's possible that a regularity of kind R holds, that all Fs are Gs without conflicting factors, or if you don't like the idea that there are regularities of that kind, then you can say Fs tend to be Gs or something like that. It's possible these things could hold, yet Fs don't cause Gs. Right. Well, physicalists face this kind of argument too. They say, you have people saying to them something like this, look, couldn't it be the case that things are physically identical in a certain kind of way? You say that if things are physically identical in a certain kind of way, then they're mentally identical in this kind of way. That's the truth of physicalism. But I, the non-physicalist, go and say possibly P and not M. There could just be a zombie with no phenomenal consciousness or something like that. Therefore, physicalism is false. And a standard physicalist response, not the only one, and this is just a little illustration, this is why the argument has a flaw, a standard physicalist response is we don't actually conceive or imagine that P, possibly P and not M, but rather possibly EP and not M, where EP is something like a mode of presentation of a physical property or some more ignorant specification of a physical property or something like that. And you've mistaken the EP for P, so you think that you've imagined something possible which shows the falsity of physicalism, but you haven't, so therefore the argument is resisted. So the human can come along and say, same is true here. Metaphysics necessary, we're claiming that if R, then C. The connection between that will be you've got the regularity, you have your, best system analysis of laws, you have your counterfactual theory, so from the regularities you derive a causal claim. You come along and you say possibly R not C, therefore the human basis of causation is false. The human response by analogy is we don't actually conceive or imagine that possibly R not C, but rather, and note the slight difference in this case, but rather possibly R and not EC. Now, EC, and obviously this is something which needs to be specified further, but EC is the cognitive grip R has on us, which makes us conceive of the FG connection as necessary. Think about what Hume said about the association of ideas. Think about what Laurie Paul said yesterday about various kinds of way in which we could see that there was a necessary or experience that there was a necessary connection between things. Let EC stand for that, right? EC is the way we identify causation, but it's not the only way we can conceive of or identify causation. So, of course, we can conceive of there being regularities in which we're not in the cognitive grip with regard to those regularities. And that's why it seems to us possible. But it's not. So my first conclusion, contentiously, but still worthy of note, is that the physicalist response, if the physicalist response to the modal argument is plausible, then a human response to the necessitarian's challenge is more plausible. Because there were those differences that I drew your attention to slightly. In the case of the physicalist case, you had to suggest that we were in some way ignorant of some physical properties. Or one might think to oneself, well, is that really what's going on here? But in the case of the in the causation case, we've got a very clear way of understanding what could be happening when we are imagining a certain possibility to be the case. We could just be thinking of this being a circumstance in which the grip is not holding. So the conditional that I'm just trying to impress upon you is the idea, if you are a physicalist and you're inclined to make those sorts of moves, then why not think that the same kind of moves should be available to the Humean with regard to the necessitarian's challenge? And of course, the person who is a Humean about causation, or rather, let me put it more precisely, the person who thinks that it is compatible with causation, that it should occur in a Humean world, is one who will just say that I am obviously being much more concessive and ecumenical with you. I'm just allowing another option, and your feeling that option shouldn't be allowed is displaying a commitment that you shouldn't actually go and take seriously. So that's the quick bit of that stuff. I see I've got through. I should just make it. So double prevention. Here's, with apologies to those who don't like neuron diagrams, I'm afraid there are a few of those in this. But I'm hoping that just about I'll manage to appear slightly more sophisticated than the crass user of neuron diagrams. But maybe that'll be a forlorn hope. So anyway, here's double prevention. The rough idea is this. Here is a long... Is there a clicker, by the way? No, doesn't matter. There's a sad tale about this. I actually asked my department for a clicker. I asked my department for a clicker because I thought it would make my presentations far more polished and effective. They bought me one, which wasn't nearly as nice as the ones I've seen other people have. But I started taking it around and it broke. And after three uses, so I'm now without again. Anyway, so I can't do little red dots on the thing or anything of that kind. So the AFE is, of course, the main causal process, but D could stop E happening. B is indeed there to stimulate D to stop E happening, but C comes along and inhibits D. So C has prevented a preventer of E. Intuition says C is a cause. Except those who are committed to causation essentially involving BIF, they want to go and say that in this particular case it's not really a cause at all. Now here's the reason why I think double prevention cases are good. The first is, of course, as you'll note, C and E, and I've put this forward for you by actually shading the things in black. You see, that makes them positive. They're positive firings, right? So these are genuine positive events. And that's one reason for thinking that double prevention cases are worth taking seriously as opposed to mere omissions. Of course, there might be some sort of omissions or negative events in the intermediary, but we've got the real positives on either side. So we're not mucking about with the dodgy stuff in between. We don't even have to talk about them too much. They're just things that might trouble you slightly. So that's the first reason. The second thing is that, you know, there are cases of, there are cases which strike me as clear cases of causation where you've got to be truly heroic to deny it. And firing of single action guns would be a case in point. I think even double action guns, but I am not from the United States, so I don't have that degree of competence. So if you think about the unfired gun, here's a little thing which I have helped for those who don't have great knowledge of firearms. When you go and pull the trigger, you see the pull the trigger, that takes away what's called the sear. I learned that for this talk. I'm always impressed when it has new tech. So you stop, you take away the sear, and the spring of the hammer takes the hammer and it goes and hits whatever's going to go and fire the bullet or something like that. So what you have is, by doing that, you're preventing a preventer of the thing which goes and fires the gun. So it is a case of double prevention. And if you go and say that double prevention cases aren't cases of causation because they don't cause BIF, then you're effectively saying that there's no causation when you kill people by guns, which might be an interesting line of defense. So this is the unfired gun, as you can see, because I've given you the key there. So you're stopping the hammer from going. And then what you go and do when you go and press the triggers, you go and do C, so you take away that, and you have the fired gun. So I take that to be good grounds for wanting to take this to be a case of causation. And I think that what that means in part is that if the counterfactuals can go and explain what is going on there, I say they're causations here, and somebody else is coming along with their BIF commitments and saying that there's no causation there, and the BIF is useful for explaining lots of things, you might be, if you're a counterfactual, you might say, well, this is just focusing upon cases of advantage to you, but of course the counterfactual group analysis groups all these nicely together, and you can't capture causation in these cases. So just as you were being too mean about the Humean supervenient world, so you are kind of being too illiberal about the double prevention cases either. Now, of course, there's a case against double prevention. That's what I want to go through now. And here I'm going to be drawing on work from Ned Hall and also from Laurie Paul and Ned Hall. I've been reading the book recently. And because I've only been reading it recently, I haven't processed all the information. So one of the things I'm doing is exposing to you my level of misunderstanding at this point. So there's two things that people go and focus on to say that there's something dodgy about double prevention cases, which means that we ought to say recognize two kinds of causation and then maybe just the counterfactualist apply to one of them if they're lucky, but they don't get to get the overall set. One is locality, and this or the denial of locality in the case of double prevention. So locality says roughly this. There are some refinements. For any causal path between C and E, at each spatial temporal position along that path, there's an event D, I, which is caused by C and is a cause of E. And of course, from the characterization of double prevention, you notice that that condition locality is not met, or doesn't seem to be met. There are various strategies you could do to try to say it was met, but let's not do them. It's not met, and so what you've got is that double prevention allows non-locality, action at a distance, on a cheap, and you don't want that. Right, so I must admit, I find this consideration not totally compelling, because I think there are two kinds of action at a distance. Yes, I skipped one, that's good. Okay, there are two kinds of action at a distance. The first one is something like this. Suppose you've got a genuine case of action at distance, there's no events between C and E. There's, you've got a gun, say, seems a theme of my talk at the moment, guns. You've got a gun and it fires an action at a distance bullet, so you fire it, kind of nothing comes out, and then it just appears in the middle of your body and you're dead. So now you could say one interesting thing about that would be that it'd be quite hard to disturb the trajectory of that bullet because, of course, it's not relying upon any of the intermediate steps. Whereas in the case of double prevention, there are kinds of things that you could do disturbing the conditions from the moment where all those sort of emissions tend to occur to the effect. There are things which you could do to disturb it where you would break the connection. Right? So in that sense, there's already one point of disanalogy. But you can imagine that there'll be some cases where that doesn't work. But what is certainly true is that the ways in which various kinds of events could disturb the connection in a genuine case of action and conditions will be ones in which they're entirely independent of the presence of C, and they go and in some way inhibit the activity of E. Whereas, of course, in the case of double prevention, the very absences we're talking about are ones which depend upon the activity of the previous state. So there's a case in point. C, although we've got a case of action at a distance, C, if it were not to occur, would actually be connected, its non-occurrence would actually be connected to the presence then of D. So there is something different going on between these two cases, and it's not unreasonable to appeal to that difference to say, well, we haven't got genuine action at a distance, we've got something else going on here. Now, exactly how you cash that out is a different matter, but it doesn't seem you're just getting action at a distance on the cheap in the damaging sense. That's that. The more substantial worry, perhaps, that people have in mind is the case of intrinsicality, but I kind of want to chip away at that too. So, here's a thought that people often have when faced with these kind of neuron diagrams and thinking about why you want to go and take the top row as a causal sequence. They go and do this, and they notice that by itself, if you abstract away the rest, that by itself seems to be a causal process, and indeed in that particular case too, it seems to be a causal process. And they want to say that that thing is what should be taken to characterize the presence of and explain why you go and have C causing causing E. So they focus on this bit, and they say that, well, they focus on that bit, but there are a few things worth bearing in mind about that bit. The chain of causes that we had here are not total causes, right? So there will be conditions which hold in virtue of which C causes D, and D causes F, and F causes E. They're just not being mentioned. The intrinsicality intuition, if it is taken at first pass, says something like this. Take the CE chain plus conditions for it holding in isolation, then if it is a causal chain there, it would be a causal chain in whatever context leaves its intrinsic structure untouched. So that's what one wants to go and say about these things. You want to go and say, the fact that you don't have a genuine chain of counterfactual dependence, or you don't have something which you could point to there, is just a function of context. So here's my version of, and I think there are possibly some changes, this being put into a thesis. This is reminiscent of what Ned Horne, what Laurie and Ned have said in the book. So you take if C, D1, D2, D3, and is a sequence of events ending of E, containing all the causes of E from the time of occurrence of E, call this the complete causal process from C to E, to an earlier time T, when C occurs, and another process, C star, D star, etc., etc., and this is intrinsically identical to it in terms of the events which constitute and their spatial temporal relations to each other, then, given that the same laws hold, C is, star is a cause of E. So what you're saying there is, take a certain sequence, if it then is intrinsically similar to another sequence, then if the first sequence is a causal process, the second one is too. That is the intuition, which is behind people who want to go and say that the cases of preemption, overdetermination, and the rest involve causation. Now, let's go and focus upon why this seems problematic in the case of the double prevention cases. You go and focus on that sequence there. That might seem to be the analogy of the corresponding thing of the AFE sequence, but you notice actually that that's not a causal sequence because it relies upon B. You see, I've managed to do that. So in the end, you think, oh God, in order to go and capture the causal sequence which relates C to E, I've got to include B in, and I've got to include A, F, and E in. I've got to include A and F in to get E there. I've got to include B in to set the dependence up for C going to E. So effectively, this is looking like a radically non-intrinsic case. And it's this thing which makes people worried about double prevention cases. The shift from the intrinsicality intuition, take the E chain plus conditions in isolation, shift between that to the intrinsicality thesis rests upon taking the remaining conditions for the CE chain to be also causes. Fans of double prevention cases might take this as question begging. I might say that you not only have to take into account causes, but also enabling conditions. And of course, if you have to take into account enabling conditions, then you'd have to take into account B, because that's the thing which is enables there to be a causal dependence in that particular case. So intrinsicality in thesis Mark 2 says all the goodness that intrinsicality thesis Mark 1 said, but adds in and intrinsic the same preconditions hold as those which held for C, D, etc., etc. The preconditions, enabling conditions clause, might be required anyway if one accepts a distinction between causes and preconditions, enabling conditions. Once one accepts that distinction, then of course you'll want it in the case of the double prevention case. So for that reason alone, you might feel that you had to go and endorse intrinsicality thesis Mark 2 in any event. However, even standard cases, putting aside that, it seems you might need enabling conditions. So for example here, and admittedly this is going to go and look like there's this amazing event coming in. Here we go, this, and suddenly there's that event, could occur, could go and disrupt the FE connection and cause E itself. And surely, in order to go and rule out that kind of case, you want a not G condition, or conditions X in which, given the laws, G would not be present, or something like that. So once you go and include stuff like that, of course, the fan of double prevention is also going to want to go and say, well, this is the sort of thing that you will motivate going and adding in the B bit. Of course, when you go like that, you might start worrying on what basis are the competing chains in redundant causation cases excluded? I mean, why not include them in too? So, and this is, I put in because I knew Murley had been the audience, so I couldn't resist going back to an old theory that he put forward. An approach to Narden, Guarneri, Murley, Ramachandran, that I defended is, if we subtract the competing causal process and the causal process in isolation, shows the same pattern of counterfactual dependence as the case of non-redundant causation. This was the good old sigma dependence account. And I just thought I'd quickly run through how it's applied. So here's the account. For any actual distinct events, E1 and E2, E1 causes E2, if and only if there's a possibly empty set of possible events, sigma, such that E2 is sigma-dependent E1, and every event upon which E2 sigma depends is an actual event, right? You're kind of thinking, what's all this going to add up to a second? I'll kind of explain it in more informal terms in a moment. So for any events E1 and E2, and any set of events sigma, E2 sigma depends on E1 if and only if neither E1 nor any of the events in sigma were to occur, then E2 would not occur. And two, if E1 were to occur without any of the events in sigma, then E2 would occur. So the rough thought is this: put in sigma an event upon the say, preempted chain, then there will be a pattern of counterfactual dependence displayed upon the preempting chain. So that's the counterfactual dependence that you focus on. And the thought goes, this captures the only sense, the only plausible sense that one has of the way in which causation is intrinsic. Namely, that when there are competing causes, something shouldn't actually be ruled out as a causal process. Simply because of that, you abstract away the other competing causes and see whether you have something which is a chain of counterfactual dependence. So built into the sigma dependence account is a notion of intrinsicality, but it's not one which goes and rules out the kind of cases of double prevention. So the subtraction answer goes roughly like this. They're the top things, right? But now we focus on the bottom ones. And you notice that the things which illuminate on the bottom ones, these are the preemptive things, contain missing events. And it's that which the sigma account appeals to. So condition two is not meant in the bottom case, and we are all right. Well, obviously not. As an analysis, there are problems with the sigma dependence accounts. Probabilistic causation caused tremendous difficulties, and I've bored people senseless trying to put together accounts which have tried to avoid the problems that that raises. But I'm going to focus on a slightly more sort of obvious difficulty when there are no gaps in the preemptive process, which people often cite, and indeed that's a case that Laurie and Ned have put forward in their book. So here is an example of it, preemption of gaps. And the nice little wrinkle on this particular case is what we have here is that the ABE1 chain preempts, as one might think, the CDE1 chain. But C and D still manage to produce something. They manage to produce E2 instead. So there's nothing which is lost. There's no missing event, right? So what you have is each chain goes and produces something. And then the challenge goes, when you are abstracting away one of these things, then what makes you think that, so in the case of the bottom thing, you've taken away the top chain, and you're thinking, just focusing upon C, D, E, and you think about that, the chain of counterfactual dependence there, is this a case of preemption or is it another chain? You say, well, what makes it the case that E2 is E2 then? Isn't it E1? So effectively there's no non-actual event which is present. So that was me going through that graphic and forgetting that I'd actually put it in nicely for you. Anyway, so there's two thoughts that one might have to that response. One thought is that, well, it's not going to have to appeal to huge sort of claims about E1 fragility. One's not going to go and say, well, no, actually, in the world in which you've now abstracted away the ABC, this is not really E1 as E2 there, because if there was only 1 second afterwards or something like that, it's not going to count as E1. You wouldn't go and say that. What, in fact, you'd say is, of course, in this world, it's not about fragility of E1, in this world, it would still be plausible to take the thing which is identified there as E1 as E2. You've just taken away the other set. It's not a far distant world or something like that. It's just talking about the individuation of events in close-by worlds. But if you don't like that, or there's some particular circumstances which make this idea inapplicable, then you could just add a condition, and I have a feeling that when Merlin and I discussed this at the time, this gave rise to counterexamples in more complex cases, but you could just add a condition that E2, at the actual time of it occurrence, T is sigma dependent upon E1, and so then you would have a restored way of distinguishing it, not relying upon actual events, but relying on the time occurrence of the events. So, the difference then between the cases of double prevention and standard cases is the double prevention cases, when they involve redundant double prevention, have a dependent kind of intrinsicality. So here, the bomber, the standard case of the bomber, the fighter, and the interceptor. You've got the key there. We've got two possible preventions. You've got one that there's a fighter which, or interceptor which shoots down the fighter, which is going to stop the bomber going and exploding at the top. On the other hand, there's H down there, which is the abort instruction. So there are two sort of things which are stopping this process from actually stopping the bomber successfully bombing. What you would go and do is you would go and take away one of the two. I've just taken it away for H there. And you would then say, well, the reason why C counts as a cause is because in the circumstance where you imagine the other one away, you have the chain of counterfactual dependence. And so you have dependent intrinsicality revealing itself even in the case of double prevention cases. All right, so let's move on, because I have a feeling I'm running out of time, aren't I? So, yes, I'm running out of time. Almost done. I realize this is slightly breakneck, but when you take me to pieces, it will go much slower, obviously, because we can focus on the various dodgy bits of the presentation. So there's one case. There's another kind of case, which I just, because I was so pleased that I did motion paths, I thought I'd just go and do this one here for you as well. So here we have the catch and the wall, and people have the following intuition, right? So there's the ball. Susie catches the ball, right? So who stopped the window from being smashed? Or what was the cause of the windows being smashed? Intuitions that some people have. I think Ned has this intuition. Not Susie, wall, because, you know, it doesn't matter whether Susie grabbed it, wall. Look, it's huge. The ball could never have got past the wall. It's the wall. I say, in this particular case, unlike the previous case, the bomber one, where I think that what we've got here is a case of overdetermined double prevention, I think in this particular case it's Susie. I think she did it. Don't detract from her. People are always doing that, right? Don't detract from her. And here's a reason for that. Here are two little things that we might be inclined to say. As it happens, suppose I built the wall to protect the window, yeah? As it happens, I didn't need the wall because the catcher caught the ball, right? And the other thing we might say in those circumstances to Susie, because one's just generally a kind of putting down person, you needn't have bothered to catch the ball because the wall was protecting the window, right? But difference is, needn't have bothered, but she did, so the wall did nothing. But I didn't need the wall because the catcher caught the ball. So catcher counts as the cause of the survival of the window in that particular case. So prevention and double prevention cases display a similar pattern of options to standard cases of redundant causation, which gives another reason for thinking that actually one should take double prevention cases to be as good for grouping as under causation as the standard cases. So my overall thought is there is a difference between dependent and non-dependent intrinsicality. I have no doubt about that. But the most substantial difference is not a difference in intrinsicality, it's a difference in the dependency of it. And that would be unfair to cite as a reason for rejecting double prevention cases. So here's an example of the thank you very much strategy, Mark II. Objection! Real causation is energy transfer, or the preservation of a conserved quantity, or the persistence of a trope, or passing of powers, or something else. Response, thank you very much. I use those to characterize what people have in mind by real causation, and obviously there's a difference between that and the double prevention cases. But double prevention cases show, and all the features that they have, show that there is something common to capture. And the counterfactual does that, counterfactual theory does that. So, concluding remarks. Anti-counterfactual theorists with big commitments have to, according to me, incur the cost of explaining why we should be so strict about the human supervenient worlds in a way which is more plausible than rejections of physicalism. And anti-counterfactual theorists with big commitments have also to deal with cases of double prevention which seem counterexamples to their BIF commitments, right? Anti-counterfactual theorists, primitivists with no BIF commitments, are not open to similar attack. They can gloat, do other things, while counterfactualists toil away. That's fine.